listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Well, St. Paul says this one event stands as the anchor of truth for everything that Christians believe. That is the resurrection, the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. Is it so purely an article of faith that when someone raises an objection like, they stole his body, or the sources of this event are completely biased, or there was a lookalike, a doppelganger, and everybody just fell prey to a huge case of mistaken identity? Is it such an article of faith that we don't even need to bother responding to those things? Joining us to answer some of the objections to the bodily resurrection of Jesus on this Friday afternoon, Shane Rosenthal. He's a regular guest. He's executive producer of the White Horse Inn radio program and author of an article for a recent edition of Modern Reformation magazine titled Answering Objections to the Resurrection. Shane, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Great to be with you.
What about that first one, which really is kind of an objection to answering objections, and that is, look, this is an article of faith. It is, you either believe it or you don't, and we don't need to cite historical evidence, much less arguments, for the bodily resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah, so that's usually the way the story's told, you know, especially on when you see documentaries on the Discovery Channel or PBS History Channel. You know, it's usually the science versus faith worldview. Most approaches go with evidence and science and rationality, and faith is a sort of subjective leap. And unfortunately, that's not merely the way it's told by others and outsiders. It's actually the way a lot of people sort of think about their own faith. They describe their own faith often in terms of a subjective leap that is just personal to them. It's personally meaningful. I guess the first way to answer that would be to say, have you read the book of Acts? If you go through the book of Acts, you don't see people saying, hey, I'd like to share something with you that's been personally meaningful to me. Typically, the structure of a sermon or an apologetic message in the book of Acts is we have seen with our own eyes something that has happened, and that which we've seen was actually fulfilling Old Testament prophecies. And that intersection between the witness of the Old Testament prophets and what they have seen with their own eyes, in other words, the contemporary first century witnesses, is the proclamation of the early church. This is something that they're proclaiming is true, and it's not done in a corner, and it's been seen by eyewitnesses, and therefore you should believe it.
So let's deal with some of these objections, the first of which really has to do with, I guess we'd call it, the primary sources. That is the four Gospels, and then, of course, we have Paul's testimony in 1 Corinthians 15 and elsewhere, of course, the kind of testimony that we find, as you mentioned, in the book of Acts as well. But the objection basically says, those who wrote all these New Testament documents, they believed already, therefore they were biased, and these texts are really not historical documents at all, but just their own personal opinions.
Yeah, this claim is made a lot in our day. In fact, I've watched a number of documentaries on the History Channel and CNN specials on Jesus with dramatic music and the voice of Liam Neeson saying these same kinds of things. The people interviewed in these specials will say again and again, this is not history. These were propagandists who are making these claims. Well, here's the problem with a biased sources approach, okay? Everybody is biased. People who believe in Jesus, yes, they're biased. People who don't believe in Jesus are biased. The problem is, if you think about the way we put together evidence in a court of law, you know, you've got a defense attorney and a prosecutor. Both are biased. So does the jury say, I can't trust any of thing that anyone's saying because they're all biased? No. You have to take account the bias and then weigh the evidence. And that's the thing that gets lost in that claim, we're not actually evaluating evidence. We're just throwing out people who are biased. The fact is, everybody's biased. If you look at the issue of the Civil War, you got people, historians writing from the perspective of the North and historians writing on the South. You have to weigh their bias. You know, as this particular historian is writing from Chattanooga, Tennessee, he may have Southern sympathies and, you know, take that in consideration. But the fact is, the Civil War happened.
Another objection is that of kind of mass hallucination, or at the very best, kind of an aggregate of individual hopeful hallucinations. They certainly are sincere, the eyewitnesses. They think they saw what they saw, but it was probably just in their mind.
So the problem with that idea is it doesn't, the first objection, the first problem with that idea is that it doesn't explain the empty tomb. I mean, if you look at the New Testament evidence, which was written as a kind of propaganda, they are trying to propagate the faith. The question still is, what's the reason for their views? What's the reason for the faith they wish to propagate? Is it true or false? And the material you find is they say things like, not only is the tomb empty, but the Jews were going around saying the disciples stole the body. In other words, it seems to be common knowledge that the tomb is empty, and if this whole thing is fiction, why would it be so plausible to so many people? Why did so many thousands convert in these with these circulating documents, and why didn't everybody just dismiss it? Well, there is an empty tomb that seems to be something people are trying to explain. And if that's the case, if it's just a hallucination, that doesn't explain the empty tomb. That is just a figment of their imagination. Just go check the tomb; it's still there. The other thing you find in the eyewitness testimony is that this is not merely something wishful thinking or hallucination, because of the number of eyewitnesses. You know, one case is 500 people, 500 brothers at the same time, and then. You know, you have the disciples saying, I refuse to believe this, what you've seen. I want to touch, I want to put my fingers in his side and in his nail prints. That's the kind of evidence we have in the documents that have been passed down to us, and it doesn't seem to match that hypothesis.
Here's one for the empty tomb, and it does acknowledge an empty tomb. And I'll give you about 30 seconds to give us the short version. We'll come back to the long version on the other side. They just stole the body. That's an old one, isn't it?
It's probably the oldest objection. Again, I mentioned it from Matthew. That is probably the oldest objection, but it is dealing with the fact that there is this this knowledge that the tomb is empty. Well, the stolen body, though, doesn't really make any sense. Why would the disciples steal the body is a good question. And the second question is how? Most likely there was a guard of 10 men, and my guess is based on research that I've done is it was probably a Jewish temple guard, not a Roman guard, which is depicted in the new movie Risen.
Oh, let's take a little break here. When we come back, we will go deeper into a response to that particular objection to the bodily resurrection of Jesus. The disciples or someone else stole the body, and more objections to respond to on the other side of the break. Shane Rosenthal is our guest, executive producer of the White Horse Inn radio program, author of a recent article for Modern Reformation magazine, titled Answering Objections to the Resurrection. When we come back, we'll deal with a myth. We'll deal with the fact that there was a doppelganger, that there was a resurrection, but it was purely spiritual, and others as well. Stay tuned.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You've enjoyed our looking forward to Sunday morning interviews with Pastor David Peterson. Did you know that there's a book with more than 60 of his Lent and Easter sermons, including daily readings for all of Lent? It's called Thy Kingdom Come. Find out more and purchase it online at emmanuelpress.us. Make Thy Kingdom Come part of your devotional life during the Lenten and Easter seasons. emmanuelpress.us. Thy Kingdom Come by Pastor David Peterson.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Doch der Sünde
Cantata 54, Endure in Spite of Sin. It's the appointed cantata for this coming Sunday. You can hear it Sunday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 8 Central at LutheranPublicRadio.org and on the LPR mobile app. These weekly Bacantatas are brought to you uninterrupted each week by the Substitute Organist Service. This is a program that will actually play your church's organ when your organist is on vacation or you don't have an organist. The program actually plays your church's organ with the skill and the art of a real professional organist, just as though they were sitting at your organ bench. You can find out more at churchmusicsolutions.com, churchmusicsolutions.com. Shane Rosenthal is our guest. He's executive producer of The White Horse Inn. We're answering objections to the bodily resurrection of Jesus. Back to the stolen body, you said the real way of answering this objection centers around two questions. Why would they do it, and how would they do it? Pick up where you left off.
Right, yeah. So, by the way, if anyone's interested, we're on the White Horse Inn. We're going to start a whole series, actually go through from March through April, the end of April, on this whole topic of the resurrection. Just going to take a few weeks to unpack all the implications, both apologetic and theological. So on this particular topic, this question, is it possible that the body was stolen by the disciples? So yeah, there's the, is it possible? And, you know, that we get information from the text that there's a guard placed on the tomb and that it refers to a plurality of men. So that's the early eyewitness information. And so if the disciples somehow were able to get past this guard and roll this big stone, then the question is, why would that be something that the early opponents of this idea would believe? For example, the Apostle Paul is a man who ended up changing the world. Well, how do we explain his faith? It's actually a fascinating book written in the 1920s by a guy named J. Gresham Machen, formerly at Princeton. He wrote a book called The Origin of Paul's Religion, and it's a good book to look at. Google it, and he has a a lot of information there that's helpful in terms of explaining how do we explain his faith if this is just a hoax. Then there's the other issue of his family members. Jesus' family members didn't believe him. If you're going to make this section up, this gospel story up, why would you have Jesus' family members thinking that he is possibly insane? And then what accounts for their new faith? You find in the book of Acts that his brothers and sisters now are believing that he was resurrected in the beginning of the book of Acts. So those are difficult to, they just don't, it doesn't fit with the hypothesis that the body was stolen, because if this was stolen, then this story is made up, and how do you convince the outsiders? And the other thing is, why would they make the story up in this particular way? And that's a question we can get into regarding the other hypotheses.
There's the Jesus myth hypothesis, and that is simply that, and we hear it all the time, that Jesus probably never even existed. This is just a Christian's attempt to kind of recycle pagan myths about dying and rising gods. They just pin that one on the mythical Jesus. What's the response?
So the best answer for that is just to point to a book by a very, very skeptical thinker named Bart Ehrman. So Bart Ehrman wrote a book called Did Jesus Exist? And he concludes that there aren't really any serious New Testament scholars. There may be a couple throughout the world, but by and large, this is 99.99% of all New Testament scholars and historians who deal with this first century material, teaching at reputable colleges. Nobody believes this. It's just not worthy of attention. There are a lot of articles on the internet that sort of put forward this view. And Bart Ehrman concludes his book by saying that this idea of the myth Jesus, these mythicists who believe that Jesus was just this fictional character, he says their actual agenda is religious, and they are not doing history, they're doing theology, albeit a kind of theology that is naturalistic. He says the real Jesus did exist whether we like it or not. And he actually says he's a historian. He's actually sympathetic to their cause, but he just can't hold it for historical reasons. So that's a really good resource, although Bart is much more skeptical than you and I. He thinks there really is a historical Jesus, and the best way to get to Jesus is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
There is the supposition of a spiritual resurrection. In other words, maybe it's best put this way. These authors who claim the resurrection, they're not really trying to say that Jesus was bodily resurrected. We misunderstand them. They're talking about the resurrection of Jesus that took place in their hearts.
Yeah, and that again, it's not what the first century documents say. If you want to know what the early Christians believed, go to the records. You know, there is such a thing as mission drift. We may be dealing with that in the American political scene. A lot of people are saying what this country is about. Best place to go is to the founding documents. In the same way, with the original documents of the church, the New Testament, you know, you have the opening of John's epistle, where he says, that which we've seen with our eyes, it's not a vision, that which we've beheld, which we've heard, which we've touched with our hands. The kinds of information you hear in, you know, Peter, for example, that I heard with my own ears on the mountain, you know, when God spoke, we are not creating myths, cleverly devised myths. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. So Thomas, again, touching Jesus and seeing. And so the spiritual idea that he was raised in our hearts, you know, it doesn't sort of work with the whole idea of the empty tomb as well. Because if it's just in our hearts, there's still a tomb which people can go see. So it doesn't really flesh out when you think about it.
There is one, and this one actually is codified in Islamic writing, and that is Jesus himself was not crucified, didn't die. Someone who looked like him died, or Jesus did die, and then a very convenient doppelganger showed up claiming to be Jesus and fooled everybody.
Yeah, so this is, as you mentioned, this is the teaching of the Quran in Surah 4, 157 through 158. Your listeners should look it up because it's a very interesting section there that shows a little bit of the Islamic dependence upon other views of Christianity at the time when Islam formed. Basically, it was formed in an area where there were Gnostic Gospels floating around, and this idea that Jesus didn't really die on the cross, but there was a lookalike. People were made to think that the guy who was there on the cross was really Jesus. Part of the reason that is a Gnostic idea is there were people who believed that Jesus couldn't have been a human being, and so he was really somewhere else spiritually while people looked at his visage on the cross. Well, that is formalized in the Quran. And my question always to anyone who is Muslim who claims that it wasn't really Jesus who died on the cross is, which are you going to believe, something written by eyewitnesses or something written 500 or 600 years later? Now, in the case of this claim, how do we explain the fact that Jesus' family members became believers in Christ? And then how do we explain the fact that Thomas, who was a twin, who said, I'm not going to believe unless I put my hands in his side. So in other words, Thomas may be saying, I'm going to make sure it's not a lookalike. that's the information we have, and that is the best material to go toward is the first century evidence, and there are really good reasons to believe that this is first century. It's established by even liberal skeptics to this day.
I don't know what to make of this one, Shane, but it's just the objection that all religious traditions, to one degree or another, make miraculous claims, and that's just what religions do, and the resurrection is just one of them.
Yeah, and that's especially popular in those who wish to dismiss all religion. For example, we had a conversation on our program with Michael Shermer, and he argued that, well, it's the same kind of claim as that which is made in the Book of Mormon. It's what religions do. they have claims, you guys have claims, the Muslims have claims, and so it all washes out. And my response to that typically is, it's one thing to claim a thing, and it's another thing to vindicate that claim. So yes, there are lots of competing claims, but the question is, what is it? Is it just a claim that that Muhammad is the prophet? Well, in this particular case, if Jesus really rose again from the dead, I submit that there is something there for us to go back and double check what he said. I mean, think about it. If someone came to you and said, "I'm God," wouldn't you expect to ask him, "Prove it"? Well, why then, when you have that in the first century, and if you say, "Ah, look, he's doing miracles, therefore we shouldn't believe it," it's sort of a catch-22. You have to do miracles in order to prove that you're God. But then when you find miracles in certain texts, people say, "Oh, that's why I'm not going to believe in the text, because it has miracle stories." The fact is, these particular texts with these particular miracles show that they can't really be explained other than Christ being who he said he was, fulfilling these Old Testament prophecies. It's the best explanation for the data. It doesn't necessarily prove that Jesus is God, but it does make us all ask, there aren't any better explanations. Let's double check what he said, what he claimed, and does it match the Old Testament prophecies? It's that intersection between the Old Testament prophecies and the eyewitness material that I think is the clincher. But from there, I go on and I express faith and trust in that resurrected Messiah.
Shane Rosenthal is our guest. He'll be with us for a few minutes on the other side of the break. On this Friday, February the 26th, we're answering objections to the bodily resurrection of Christ. We'll take a break with him. And then when we come back, we'll look at a variation on the stolen body. No one stole him. It was just a huge mistake. The body was misplaced. It's still there someplace, like your car keys. And that also explains the empty tomb. We'll be right back.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners notice first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Joining us each week through the November elections, journalist Molly Hemingway of The Federalist and Mark Hemingway of The Weekly Standard.
I don't think anybody who's thinking rationally actually thinks that Donald Trump would be good on issues of marriage, abortion, religious freedom.
It's been reported that, you know, one of the few soft spots in Trump's support among Republicans is that of weekly churchgoers.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth, Issues Etc. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're answering objections to the bodily resurrection of Christ. Shane Rosenthal is our guest. A few more minutes with him.
Shane, here's another one. It's kind of a variation on the stolen body, but this one does explain the empty tomb, and it kind of lets the disciples off the hook, and that is the misplaced body. He was laid in a tomb. He's still there. They just kind of mistaken which tomb they should be looking in, and that explains the empty one.
Yeah, and that's, again, there's a plausibility to all these, and I suggest that we think about all these, you know, objections through, because, again, there's a certain plausibility. So, you know, with a stolen body, we have to say that they did this intentionally to deceive, and then they went out and wrote certain stories about Jesus saying that he was resurrected, so they're telling lies. So then the question would be, why would they tell these lies, suffer for that proclamation? Why would they tell these lies in the certain way that they did, with four different stories? Why would they say it with interesting elements like women witnesses who were the first to see Jesus resurrected from the dead? That actually was a liability in the first century. It's meaningful for us today, but in the first century, you know, why would you, if you're making a story up, why would you have female witnesses? Because they weren't respected in a court of law. So there are all kinds of difficult questions. When you get to the question of the misplaced body, that I think is a little bit more plausible than the stolen body, because it could explain why so many people believed it, because this idea of the empty tomb surprises the church. The challenge, however, is that in this particular case, you know, we have a chain of custody reported in the New Testament documents. You know, first of all, there is a guard placed at the tomb. They know which tomb the body is placed in. Then we have Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus and followers of Jesus who are there putting spices on quickly before the Sabbath. So there's a particular chain of custody. When we have the reports on Easter Sunday, it's interesting that the linens again and again are mentioned as still being present. Why, if the body was stolen or misplaced, why would you still have linen wrappings there? If it's stolen, you know, you unwrap the body and you're hauling away this naked body. And if it's misplaced, you know, why would all the wrappings be there in this tomb? That doesn't fit the evidence at hand.
There's one that also has a kind of veneer of plausibility. That's a swoon theory. Jesus didn't die. He fell unconscious or into a coma and then manages to recover in the tomb, come out conveniently on the third day, and claim a resurrection.
Yeah, the swoon theory, the fact that he didn't die is has been around a long time, but not a whole lot of scholars treat this with any respect. In fact, there's a book called The Resurrection by a scholar named Geza Vermes. Looks like Geza Vermes, but he is a he actually walks through a lot of these objections in his book, and he actually discounts this one as just it doesn't hold any water. He doesn't believe in the historic resurrection, but most of these objections he discounts himself. And one of the problems with it is the fact that if you are looking at the data from the New Testament, you know, there's a pier that is piercing Jesus' side, blood and water flow. There was an article in the 80s from the Journal of the American Medical Association. I link it in the article that I wrote, which basically says that this panel of doctors were looking at the evidence and they're saying, no, basically the blood and water flowing. They didn't know what they were reporting, but basically it's a sign that there was fluid around the cardiac heart sac of the heart, and there's no way he can survive. And even if he had survived, how does he get the stone open? How does he get out of the tomb? And now he's alive, so now we're back at the, you know, embellishment issues, because they say he's alive and he's ascending into heaven, when in fact he's actually alive, wounded, and living somewhere, you know, where in Bethany, you know, shopping at the local store. So,
one real quick one with 30 seconds. There's no way to prove this one way or the other. What's your response?
Well, there's no way to prove that you were born in the city that is on your birth record. It's just words on a page. There's no way to prove where you were married. You know, history is like this. We have this issue of eyewitness testimony in a court of law. If you have an eyewitness to a murder, it's just basically one person's word. Well, there's a question here of when you have an eyewitness, the eyewitness is telling you something you can't know otherwise. That's why you have his testimony there in a case such as a murder trial. You can't know what happened unless you talk to this person. Now, the question is, do we trust this person or not? How do we determine whether or not a particular eyewitness is trustworthy? Well, that's how that's the question for a jury to actually look at the evidence. And in this case, the New Testament documents are the primary source eyewitness accounts. And, you know, your listeners should go to those documents and ask, are these witnesses credible? And in this particular case, they are the most credible. All the other theories just don't end up holding water at the end of the day, because it ends up, you know, being this this thing that you have to make up, this this outlandish hypothesis. Yes, it's difficult to believe in a resurrection, but when you look at who this Jesus was and how he matched Old Testament prophecy, you begin to say with Peter, death could not keep its hold on this man. This was a unique man, and all that Isaiah 53, you know, if you look at Isaiah 53, this particular text written 750 B.C. talks about a suffering servant who would die for the sins of Israel, and then it says he would be put into the grave. And then, after he is cut off from the land of the living and placed in a grave with the wicked, it says he will see the light of life, and he will, God will prolong his days. We have here in 750 BC a prophecy of Christ's death for sin, an atoning death, and then a masterful and a mysterious resurrection. Well, those are the kinds of things that the New Testament apostles and evangelists are pronouncing, that Jesus fulfilled these prophecies. And so the fact that they would lie about these things just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, especially if they're going to willingly suffer the rest of their lives persecution and difficulty and hardship, knowing that those things were false.
Shane Rosenthal is executive producer of the White Horse Inn radio program, author of a recent article for Modern Reformation magazine titled Answering Objections to the Resurrection. You'll find links to the White Horse Inn and Modern Reformation magazine under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Shane, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on, and it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Robert Spencer is next. We'll talk about the Islamic State's abduction of Christians for ransom money. Then we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.